Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Don't know where that 2001 Space Odyssey music came in there. You just never know. But at least it gives it a climactic flair as we enter the program. I just hope the rest of the show is not a letdown. Hope you're doing well this morning. Two big guests next hour, both men of the cloth, of course. Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, who is gracious enough to come on every several months on the program. He is the Archbishop of Louisville, and he is also the president, at least for the rest of this year, I think, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And he's been gracious enough that he'll be on with us next hour. We'll talk about a few things. One is a long-awaited bill here in the state of Kentucky, where we broadcast from, but should be interest to pro-life people everywhere, what we call the informed consent, that women who are seeking an abortion need to have a greater sense of what it is that they're doing, have a period to have a consultation with a physician regarding the nature of abortion and what it entails. And it's always very interesting, of course. And, you know, I mean, I guess there are all kind of hypocrisies and politics and moral issues. It's just part of the human condition. We tend to see things our own way. But, you know, on so many other things, we understand the importance of consent and information. And, you know, the internet is driven by a proliferation of, you know, these websites like WebMD. And so we're all about informing people. And yet when it comes to the issue of abortion, it seems like those committed to an abortion ideology seem to shy away from that and tend to, in my view, it's a reasonable restriction. I don't understand why that couldn't be agreed upon. But now it has been here in the state of Kentucky with a little compromise. And we'll talk to the bishop about that. Also, I want to talk to him a little bit about Catholic Schools Week, which is going on this week, as well as National Marriage Week, which is coming up. And also want to pick his brain on, you know, we're in a big election season, of course. We always think of it that way in the years that we elect presidents. And how is a Catholic to navigate through the voting booth in this, what seems to be increasingly partisan atmosphere and political culture that we're in which, as yesterday, we talked to Tim Stanley from the Daily Telegraph in London about this sense in which, you know, because the Catholic faith is not entirely reflected in either major party platform, the more extreme the platforms of each party get in terms of candidates, the more polarized, the more difficult it becomes for a Catholic. And so we'll ask him about that question. Also want to ask him, what are some things he's learned during his 2 years so far as the leader of the U.S. bishops? Then at the bottom of the next hour, we'll talk to Father Alan Carter. After a one-week break, he'll be back for his First Cup Theology segment. And we'll get back to this whole question about the year of mercy and the issue of abortion, and particularly confession. I was talking to Father Alan yesterday and saying that I would imagine as a priest going into the confessional, to hear confessions is a little bit like Forrest Gump's box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. You may have a series of relatively superficial type sins or run-of-the-mill, and then all of a sudden you get someone who's not been to confession in 20 years, and they're haunted by some very profound regret from their life. It's got to be an interesting thing, and as we've seen in so many other cases, the role of the priest hearing confession, the face of grace that he exhibits toward the penitent can make a big difference in their return to the church. So that'll be a good conversation to have. We'll also look back in history today. We'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, give our What Were You Thinking awards. And I'll give you one more reason to love the Atlantic Magazine. You've heard me probably ad nauseum say that among the type of publications that the Atlantic is, and the Atlantic's been around a long time. I mean, my goodness. I mean, the Battle Hymn of the Republic was first published in the Atlantic back in the 1860s. But I think it's one of the more fair-minded publications out there, and in an age in which it's hard to find fair-minded publications. So I'll give you one more reason, because interesting piece Emma Green, who's been a guest on the program before, had on the issue of abortion. So I guess we're dealing with that issue a lot today. For our prayer today, I want us to pray a prayer. It's called A Prayer for All People by St. Clement of Rome. St. Clement, I believe the third pope You can he's from this prayer composed right around 100 A.D. We actually have written work from St. Clement, including an epistle that he wrote. So we're going to pray this prayer for all people, and whatever concern or need that you have that you want to lift up, maybe you've got something coming down today that's not something you're looking forward to facing, or maybe there's some issue or struggle that nobody knows about, but God does. This is a chance to lift it up in prayer. And in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. We beg you, Lord, to help and defend us. Deliver the oppressed, pity the insignificant, raise the fallen, show yourself to the needy, heal the sick, bring back those of your people who have gone astray, feed the hungry, lift up the weak, take off the prisoner's chains. May every nation come to know that you alone are God, that Jesus Christ is your child, that we are your people, the sheep that you pasture. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. St. Clement of Rome, pray for us. We'll also, next segment, give you the question of the day. But you're free to call in 573-4-BREAD-4 or text 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post any comment or question on Facebook or on Twitter. Looking at the reading for today, we've been following the life of King David, man after God's own heart. As I said, they really need to make another King David movie. It could be an epic, maybe get Kevin Costner involved. You know, he likes those epics. But there hasn't really been a good King David movie since Richard Gere played the title character back in the 80s, which, as I said, it's not a bad film in many ways. So there's some artistic license, as there tends to be. But that's what I never get about many of these biblical dramas. I saw the film Noah a couple of years back, which I was really anticipating because my man crush for Russell Crowe as an actor is well documented. And so I thought, man, Russell Crowe is Noah, what's not to like? And, you know, it wasn't as bad as I expected it to be, yet it was kind of weird, the whole rock people thing. I'm still trying to get my mind around. But my question is, on so many of these things, why take liberties at all? There's plenty in the biblical text. There's plenty in the story. It's, you know, if you have not read the scriptures in a while, if you've not read Genesis, for example, or if you've not read the story of King David, starting in 1 Samuel and continuing on, and then also reading there at the beginning of 1 Kings, what you need to do is read them, because if all you have is a memory of a child's Bible storybook, and there's a place for that, of course, but you will be surprised if you get in and read those, how complex the characters are, particularly in some of these stories like King David, where much time is taken to unfold his personality over a lifetime. Character development. We love that kind of stuff, right? I mean, that was one of the reasons I think that people liked the Netflix series or the AMC series Breaking Bad so much. And really, as my friend Jason Hall, who'll be actually on the program tomorrow, has said, one of the great things about Breaking Bad and the potential of television as opposed to movies is that television can really develop characters. You can really come to know them, see them, nuances and shifts in their character, and you can see all that in that film Breaking Bad. Well, you can actually see that in a story like King David, one of these epic heroes, much like Moses, for example, or Abraham. And you really, there's plenty in the biblical text without having to take artistic liberties. Same is true of David. Anyway, I digress. We're here at 1 Kings 2 today. The time of David's death draws near, and he's giving instructions to his son Solomon. Solomon, the son of Bathsheba, the woman whom David had the adulterous affair with, whose first child died, but it was Solomon, and of course Solomon who would continue on the legacy of David, God's providence and his ability to work even through our sin. That's one of the reasons when you read the genealogy of Jesus of Matthew, Bathsheba's name is right woven in there with the genealogy of Jesus. Even something that was so scandalous and immoral, because no matter where we are and what we've done, if we surrender it to God and his purposes, nothing in life need ever be wasted. It doesn't make the mistake or the sin a good thing in and of itself. That something that's bad is bad, but the power of God is that he can take, you know, he can write straight with crooked lines, so they speak, say, and you look all through Scripture and you see evidence of that. So David's death is drawing near. He's giving instructions to his son Solomon, who will continue his dynasty, who will continue his rule, and he says, I'm going the way of all flesh. Take courage and be a man. Keep the mandate of the Lord your God, following his ways, observing his statutes, commands, ordinances, and decrees as they are written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in whatever you do. I almost wonder if David also didn't say, don't ask me how I know, or do as I say, not as I do. I want to pick this back up at the start of the next hour because, like I said, there's a lot here. A lot of phrasing here that's very, very important. They give us a real good insight into David, including the phrase, David rested with his ancestors. Important concept, especially in the nature of authority. So we'll pick all this up in the next hour. We'll have our question of the day coming up. Musically oriented question of the day in the next segment. We'll have a little bit of fun with that. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Little Fleetwood Mac there. That's our question of the day, actually. 1977 on this day was the release of the album Rumors, Fleetwood Mac's best-selling album of all time. And routinely listed whenever you see votes on the greatest albums of all time. Rumors certainly in the conversation. It was actually the first album I ever owned. I had owned some little 45 singles. So you see, kids, there were these things called record players back in the day. And I actually had some singles before that. But my first big vinyl album was Rumors, because a friend of mine gave it to me on my 12th birthday party, 1978. So the album was a little over a year old, but man, I wore that thing out for many, many years. I wish I still had it, actually. Though I know you can buy them again, but I digress. So my question of the day is, what is your favorite song by Fleetwood Mac or any of its members? So not only, of course, did you have many of the great hits from Fleetwood Mac, but you had artists like Lindsey Buckingham, Stevie Nicks, and Christine McVie, all who had solo careers as well. And of course, Dreams there being sung by Stevie Nicks. Well, I'll give you another example from that Rumors album. And there was not a bad song on this album. Another song on that album. Oh, Go Your Own Way.
My internet went down.
Oh, internet went down. Fun times. Okay, so anyway, we'll bring that up later. But you may have one that you want to give us a call. We've gotten some comments on Facebook on this question already, which you are welcome to do at Mike Allen Show, the handle there on Facebook or on Twitter. Let's see. Mark says, Go Your Own Way. Steven says, Landslide. Got to agree with you on that. Chelsea says, Never Going Back Again, and I have a soft spot for You Make Loving Fun, which is her parents' song. Also blast Edge of Teen when I come across it on the radio. We'll try to do the same here in a little bit later, Chelsea. So again, your favorite Fleetwood Mac song or a song by any of its artists, Lindsey Buckingham, Christine McVie, or Stevie Nicks, 573-4BREAD-4, which you can call or text. Or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, and would love to hear from you. Some sports kind of related issues. I do have to say I feel a little bit like an idiot. Certainly not the first time that's ever happened in my life. My sports credibility taking a hit, because I think it was on Monday maybe or Tuesday. I was talking about the Super Bowl. I was talking about the Carolina Panthers. And, oh, yeah, we were talking about the novena that Charlotte area Catholics are praying for a victory. And I mentioned a Catholic on the Panthers roster. This just goes to show you that I don't actually watch that much NFL. This is the beauty of the internet and SportsCenter in particular and highlights, is that it's rare for me to watch an entire NFL game. And part of the reason is my Tampa Bay Bucks, being as cellar dwellers as they often are and not here locally where I live, I don't see them on TV. So I pronounced this Panthers linebacker as Luke Kuechly when it's really Keekly. So I'm afraid I really wounded my sports credibility with you, whatever level it was at already, but it took a real hit. So Luke Kuechly is his name. I'm pulling for the Broncos. I think I finally decided, though I don't really have a dog in the fight. I wouldn't mind seeing Peyton Manning go out, but with a win, if in fact he is going out, redeem himself just a little bit. But if the Panthers were to win, there's a certain degree you got to just tip your hat to greatness, and the Panthers have clearly been the best team in the NFL this year, so it would certainly be a worthy championship for them. Big day in college football yesterday, of course, National Signing Day, and always interested to see what my Kentucky Wildcats are going to do. And according to their head coach, Coach Mark Stoops, the best recruiting class he's had by far at the University of Kentucky. But the problem is that you're playing in the SEC, the Southeastern Conference. And looking at the recruiting rankings from ESPN's Insider yesterday, and 8 of the top 20 ranked recruiting classes in the nation going to Southeastern Conference teams, and my Kentucky Wildcats, not one of them. In fact, Kentucky down at 35th, which is pretty good, actually a rank ahead of their arch rival Louisville. However, it places them 12th out of the 14 teams in the SEC, which is typically about where Kentucky places in the standings of the SEC on a decent year. So, lather, rinse, repeat. Seems like more of the same. Now, you can say, Mike, don't be a pessimist. Recruiting rankings don't mean all that much. Coach them up. Well, the problem is Nick Saban's going to be coaching them up too, as is Les Miles and Gus Malzahn and all the rest. They're going to be all coaching them up. And, recruiting rankings do mean something. It just means that your margin of error is much bigger, I'd say, when you've got talent like that. So football fans everywhere, of course, following the recruiting rankings. And then last other sports tidbit I'll mention, last night, and I know particularly Keith, my board op, gets tired of me talking about it, but Stephen Curry with 25 points in the first quarter last night against the Washington Wizards, 36 at the half, ends up with 51 points as the Warriors win their 8th straight game. 30, that makes them now 45-4. And I saw in one ranking, I think ESPN's top 50 NBA players or top 100 NBA players of all time, they've now got Stephen Curry, I think, at 23rd all time. And he's a young man, so who knows how high he could climb. But, man, that's impressive. If they can win a second straight NBA championship this year, and if they can beat the Bulls record, I think you got to talk about the Warriors. Can we say among the greatest NBA teams of all time? I don't know. 573-4-BREAD-4, if you got an opinion on that. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. What's incredible, of course, is you may have, this may be like Maguire Sosa, who both broke Maris's home run record. You may have both Golden State and San Antonio, who's playing really, really well, too, except when they play Golden State, beating the Bulls record. So it'll be worth keeping an eye on. All right, let's move on to our What Were You Thinking awards for the day. Again, spanning the globe, finding examples of, let's just say, a lack of the virtue of prudence. As has been often said, as we've talked about on the program before, what makes human beings great is the very thing that can also make us pretty darn dumb at times. So here we've got, let's see, Ski resort seeks prosecution of snowboarder who they say triggered avalanche. A California ski resort wants criminal charges against a snowboarder who allegedly triggered an avalanche Friday in a closed area at Donner Summit. Snowboarder Christian Michael Mayers gained attention after a YouTube video showed him tumbling in the avalanche at the Sugar Bowl Resort in Norden, California. Mr. Mayers, who officials said was not a resort season pass holder, was wearing a GoPro camera. "Yup, that just happened," Mars said as he struggled to move from the fall. Later on Facebook, he said, "Luckily, I swam my way to the top and didn't get buried. I definitely got lucky." Resort officials said they investigated the incident and are now working with the Placer County Sheriff's Department as they seek Mayer's prosecution. Here's the problem, right? Mayer's evidently went out on social media and put footage of exactly what he did out there. And now it's coming back to bite him. So, again, social media brings another one down. Let's see. Number two, how about... what was it here? This was a guy. Oh, yeah, serial bank robber. Here we go. Serial bank robber in the blue jumpsuit caught after hitting 10 banks, New York Police Department. A serial bank robber who's been wearing a blue painter's jumpsuit was arrested after he hit 10 Manhattan banks within a few months, including five in a single day. You know, there's that old saying, going to the well once too often. The suspect, 43-year-old Abdul Harley, who's homeless, was wanted for five bank robberies that occurred between November and January. He was finally arrested after he robbed five more banks on Thursday. Five in one day, all in the blue jumpsuit. So you may want to be a bit a little more selective as you're out robbing banks. But the winner we're going to give here, this woman who has a 420 tattoo on her forehead that read 420. A woman wants 420 tattoo removed from her forehead. She's actually started a GoFundMe campaign. You just got a picture of her here. Tabitha West, she's got a 420 tattooed right there on the top of her face. And, of course, 420 is a common reference to marijuana. As she said on her GoFundMe page, "I'm wanting to get that tattoo off my head because I want to get a better start in life and have a second chance at life. Please help me. I was young and dumb." Okay, at least she knows it. "When I got that, I'm older. Now that I'm older, looking for a job. People call me a druggie every day of my life." Imagine that. Yeah, kids, you want a job. Don't get the worldwide numerical slang for pot tattooed on your forehead. Now, the amazing thing is, I'm not sure who gets the "What Were You Thinking" award, the woman or the people who've given over $1,000 over her goal of $800 through GoFundMe. Ah, the human condition. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. Right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Next hour, my guest, Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, who is the Archbishop of Louisville, will be with us. We'll talk a little bit about the informed consent bill that got signed into law by the governor here in the state of Kentucky. I know Archbishop Kurtz, who is the Archbishop of Louisville, with the other bishops in the state, three other ones, working together. As I've said before, most states that have more than one diocese have what's called a Catholic conference. We had Tom Chapman, for example, as the executive director of the Iowa Catholic Conference, and they work for the legislative concerns of the bishops of the state, really applying the Catholic moral and social principles to the legislative sphere, not to advance a particular faith vision, but a view of the common good. And the bishops in the state of Kentucky have been working for some time with their Kentucky Catholic Conference, Jason Hall, who's the director, and he'll be with us tomorrow to talk a little bit more about this. But they've been working for years on an informed consent bill to so that any woman who's seeking an abortion needs to have a face-to-face consultation with a physician, just so she can be fully aware of what's involved. And like I said, we believe on about consent and information and all those sorts of things on so many other issues. Why not on this issue? And finally, they were able to, after it had been stalled out in the House of Representatives, not even able to get out of committee onto the floor because there were some, particularly typically some pro-abortion Democrats who blocked it, finally got out there on the floor, got voted in, and the governor signed it, and so now it's law. Now, there was a slight compromise in that that face-to-face meeting could be held via video or Skype or whatever. So I'll be interested in his take on that. I also want to just get his wisdom on bringing the Catholic faith to bear in the whole voting process. We're in a big election year, and as I said, things are getting more partisan, it seems like, in our politics, and particularly during the primary season, it seems candidates even more extreme in their ideology. And oftentimes when you get to the edge of a party's platform, the rightward edge or the leftward edge, you tend to sacrifice some things that are pretty key to the Catholic social and moral vision. So how do we navigate that? How do we make sense? Also, I just want to ask him what he's learned as the president of the U.S. Catholic Bishops during his last couple of years there. And then at the bottom of the next hour, we'll have Father Alan Carter on the program. So all that and look forward to. Certainly taking your questions or comments today. My question of the day on the 39th anniversary since the album Rumors, Fleetwood Mac's really greatest work, I think, was released. What is your favorite song by Fleetwood Mac or any of its members? Solo artist Stevie Nicks, Christine McVie, and Lindsey Buckingham. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Couple of other comments we've gotten on this. Let's see. Patrick says Gypsy or Sarah are tops in his book. Shayla says Tusk. Let's see. Mark says Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Deacon Joe says Dreams, which we played a little bit earlier. Tom, Landslide. Again, got to agree with you on Landslide. Dana says Everywhere. James says The Chain. And William says Never Going Back Again, particularly loves Buckingham's guitar work. So if you want to comment, we'd love to hear from you on that. You can also text 573-4BREAD-4 as well. Oh, there we go. We had a little Fleetwood Mac hopping in there. It's all right, Keith. We can play that if you've got it. All right, very good. All right, that's also on the album Rumors, which I said there's not a bad song on that album. Speaking about the abortion issue, which we've been talking about, we're going to talk with Archbishop Kurtz next hour about, and particularly with politics, came across an article in theatlantic.com. Now, you've heard me time and time again affirm my appreciation for The Atlantic as a magazine, also known as The Atlantic Monthly. It's been around a long, long time. As I said, the original lyrics to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, when they were released, came out in 1862, I think, in The Atlantic. So we're talking about a publication that didn't just fall off the journalism truck. But it's like it's in with a group of magazines that I think tends to tilt maybe a little bit to the left. Maybe magazines like, let's say, Slate or Salon. But here's the difference, in my view, in between The Atlantic and some of those other publications is, even though I have little doubt that most of the writers for The Atlantic tilt left of me, I think, by and large, the publication is very fair-minded and really tries to balance its partisanship. Because one of the frustrations for me anymore, it seems like, and we've talked about this hyper-partisan world that we live in, is that, you know, when I go to some of the places that I do research in preparation for this show, and one of those websites, for example, is realclearpolitics.com, which really, as well, strives to be an unbiased resource. They tend to post articles that give equal time to both conservatives and liberals, which is helpful in a sense because you can see what each side is saying about a particular issue. But you also, therefore, at least I do, I tend to, when I see the publication the article is in, I tend to take it with a grain of salt, depending on the publication. Now, that can be an article that is written from the perspective of the left, like Slate or Salon or Mother Jones or one of these. When I immediately see it's from one of those significantly leftist publications, I automatically begin to have a healthy dose of skepticism. I consider the source mentality. Unfortunately, I tend to do the same thing on the right if it's from Breitbart or if it's from National Review. Though I used to love National Review, but I think National Review has drifted over into that territory there where it's almost a shrill shouting down of the opposition. The Atlantic, I think, on the whole, is among the most fair-minded pieces. And case in point, this article by Emma Green, who's been a guest on this program before, who writes really on religion issues in the Atlantic. She has a piece here, and I'm going to link it on our Facebook page, The Progressive Roots of the Pro-Life Movement. A new book looks at the history of anti-abortion advocacy before Roe v. Wade, arguing that today's activists are much different than their predecessors. Now, just the fact that in the title of the piece, Emma Green uses the term pro-life, to me, is a major plus. Because in most mainstream media, there is an unwritten rule that you refer to pro-life people as anti-abortion, and you refer to pro-abortion people as pro-choice. That's the standard nomenclature, which I think sets the terms and frames the debate almost from the beginning. So the fact that Emma Green talks about pro-life people, I always think it's a plus when you can represent people on their own terms, and she does that. Now, I have no idea where Emma Green comes down on this issue. But in reviewing this book, Defenders of the Unborn, by the historian Daniel K. Williams, she says he looks at the first years of the self-described pro-life movement in the United States, focusing on the long-overlooked era before Roe. And according to Williams, he says, too many historians took for granted that the pro-life movement emerged as a backlash against feminism or as a backlash against the Supreme Court decision in 1973. But as he says, the pro-life movement that we have always labeled conservative was at one time much more deeply rooted in the liberal, rights-based values than we might have expected. Without knowing this history, Williams argues, this is in Green's piece, it's difficult to understand why pro-life views have had such staying power in American politics, even as public opinion on other social issues, such as LGBT rights and birth control use, have steadily shifted to become more permissive. Abortion, he says, has a different history. Its early opponents thought it was their duty and their government's duty to protect the unborn alongside the poor and the weak. They believed their position offered women empowerment, not oppression. And as she goes on to write, more importantly, this history shows how contorted the abortion debate has become as women's bodies and children's futures have been turned into rhetorical proving ground for politicians left and right. Today, pro-life Democrats are nearly extinct, and openly pro-choice Republicans rarely make it to a national stage like this year's presidential race. 50 years ago, this wasn't the case. What happened to America's progressive pro-lifers? It's a great question, and it really reflects an article that I read a number of years ago that talked about the great partisan crisscross that happened on the issue of abortion. That if you went back 60 years, let's say, and you told people that the pro-abortion movement or the advocacy movement would primarily take root and flourish in the Democratic Party, people would have scratched their heads because they would have thought it more likely fit into a Republican Party platform, particularly sort of the Rockefeller Republican idea. Democrats, after all, were about the party of the little guy, about organized labor. You had a large predominance. It was almost a given that if you were a Catholic, you were a Democrat back in the day. And so if you understand abortion as those who are pro-life as defending the little guy, the rights of the most vulnerable, then in some ways you could say it fit, historically speaking, much more into the Democratic Party platform. We'll pick back up on this on the other side of the break, because I mean, for a story like this to get into a major publication by The Atlantic, I think it's a good thing, and maybe get people to think outside the box a little bit on this issue rather than be so entrenched as we oftentimes are. We'll be back in just a minute to continue this conversation. We'll also look back in history. This is The Mike Allen Show. Little Stevie Nicks there. Landslide, my favorite Stevie Nicks song, I think. I know the Dixie Chicks did a remake, but come on. Dixie Chicks aren't Stevie Nicks. My question of the day, on this day 39 years ago, Rumors released the Fleetwood Mac album that really became their gold standard. My question is, what's your favorite Fleetwood Mac song or a song by any of its members, whether it would be Lindsey Buckingham or Christine McVie, or Stevie Nicks? 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Shannon saying it would be easier for her to say the songs that she doesn't like. I guess her father wore this particular album out. We parents can sometimes do that, I would suppose. She goes, this is one of those albums I snuck from my dad's album collection and played over and over again on the old turntable. Oh, she's saying that she likes so many of them. There'd only be a few she doesn't like. She said, Landslide, Sarah, Dreams, and Gypsy are my favorites. So I would love to hear from you on that. Back to this story, this article from The Atlantic that I said in many ways from Emma Green reflected this piece that I read from Human Life Review from a number of years ago called Crisscross, Democrats, Republicans, and Abortion. And McKenna begins his article here. He says, suppose a politically savvy Rip Van Winkle in, say, 1965, perceiving that a movement to legalize abortion was gaining strength in the country, were asked, which of the two major political parties will eventually identify with that movement? What would he answer? I think he would mull it over in his head for a while and then say, the Republicans, probably. Why? Well, in the first place, it fits pretty well into the Republicans' private property philosophy. Let's keep government out of a woman's most personal property. Secondly, consider the demographics. The Republicans draw heavily from the upper middle class WASPs, that would be white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, where the drive for population control has always come from. Abortion fits very well into the old eugenics mythology, the belief that you can improve the health of the race by limiting the breeding of undesirables. You can still hear echoes of that in the conversations of bicoastal Republicans. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the Republican Party came out with a plank saying we support abortion, in certain cases, for the nation's overall health and well-being. Finally, the Republicans' emphasis on the need for law and order and their conservative approach to welfare, the Republicans may not say this out loud, but it slots right into their conservative ideology. Abortion is good because by holding down illegitimate births, it will cut down on crime and welfare costs. But McKenna says, what about the Democrats? Well, Rip Van Winkle would say, let's start again with demographics. Consider the heavy concentration of Roman Catholics in the Democratic Party. The church hierarchy would go bananas if any prominent Catholic Democrat, or any Democrat at all, came out in favor of abortion. This, again, Rip Van Winkle's perspective from 1965. The church has consistently held that abortion is one of the gravest moral offenses because it involves the direct killing of an innocent human being. No way is a Catholic Democrat or any Democrat who wants Catholic support going to support abortion. Isn't that fascinating? Now, here we sit to where abortion and almost unlimited access to abortion has become virtually an intrinsic, almost sacramental presence in the Democratic Party platform. And it's the Republicans who tend to run, at least on the abortion issue, as the pro-life party. Now, Emma Green deals with this in a very much similar way. She looks back on the history of this. And like I said, for a publication like The Atlantic, a probably left, middle to left tilting publication, to have a very balanced and fair-minded piece like this is just another reason for me to love The Atlantic. Emma Green says, looking back on this in the days before Roe v. Wade, she says, a handful of courts were taking on a different aspect of the debate, whether abortion was a violation of human rights. From 1939 to 1958, five state Supreme Courts and the U.S. District Court in D.C. handed down rulings that recognized fetal personhood. These rulings lined up with the convictions of theologically conservative Catholics who believed that life begins at conception, and this group may very well have influenced the decisions. New York gynecologist Alan Guttmacher, in fact, the founder of the Guttmacher Institute, wrote in 1963, "The Catholic Church is so well mobilized and makes up such a large percentage of the population that changing the law of any state in the northeast of the USA is a virtual impossibility, at least for the next several decades." Wow. And we tend to think of the Northeast now as the most friendly to the abortion cause. Guttmacher saw it as just the opposite in 63 because of the presence and the influence of the Catholic Church and of Catholics. Emma Green says, though these Catholics may have been theologically conservative, in other words, in what they believed about God, for example, most of them were not what most Americans would consider politically conservative, either by mid-century or contemporary standards. There were some political conservatives who participated in the early movement, Williams, who wrote this book that Emma Green is reviewing, but for the most part, the public rhetoric of the pro-life movement tended to be grounded in liberalism as seen through a mid-20th century Catholic lens. It's New Deal, Great Society, liberalism. Emma Green writes, for most mid-century American Catholics, opposing abortion followed the same logic as supporting social programs for the poor and creating a living wage for workers. Catholic social teachings, outlined in documents such as the 19th century encyclical Rerum Novarum. Now, hold on. Drop the mic. You got Rerum Novarum mentioned in The Atlantic? On an article about the pro-life movement? Wow. Catholic social teachings outlined in documents such as Rerum Novarum argued that was a letter written by Pope Leo XIII, which formed the foundation of modern Catholic social teaching. Anyway, Rerum Novarum argued that all life should be preserved from conception till death and that the state has an obligation to support this cause. These Catholics, these mid-century American Catholics, believed in expanded prenatal health insurance, an insurance that would also provide benefits for women who gave birth to children with disabilities. They also wanted a streamlined adoption process, aid for poor women, and federally funded child care. Although Catholics wanted abortion outlawed, they also wanted the state to support poor women and families. Really encourage you to read this article, because what it does is I think it really highlights why so many Catholics who really take both the social and the moral teachings of the church, and as we've said before, Catholic teaching is a Jenga tower. You can't just start picking and choosing. You have those on the left who have those items on the Catholic buffet line of Catholic teaching that they want to treat like a cafeteria and pick and choose. And you have some who are on the far right politically as Catholics who want to do the same thing. And we find ourselves on so many issues so politically homeless. Now, some of that, you know, some of that is okay because it does remind us that we have a dual citizenship. I mean, we are citizens of the country in which we live, of course, most of us, and we have a citizenship in heaven. Of course, the citizenship in heaven is always primary. Our identity as a Christian, as a disciple of Jesus, should always take precedence over our identity as a national citizen, period. And so the reality that we oftentimes find ourselves politically homeless in terms of finding a party that in any way encapsulates the fullness of the vision of the human person, that's a good reminder for us that we are not ultimately going to find redemption in the political process. Doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that Catholics can therefore simply abdicate the political process or withdraw or become some sort of isolationist in their faith, like they want to just get hunkered down. We have to engage in the public square, but never believing ultimately that Christ's kingdom is accomplished through legislative means, though we do certainly work for the common good and we bring our faith to bear on issues and we have a voice in a democratic society. As long as we have a voice, we should use it. But on the other end, it shows how strangely imbalanced our political world has become and how inconsistent both of our parties are across a whole host of issues. And understanding this historical shift and how it somehow took place, and I want to encourage, I'm linking this article. I'm also going to link the Human Life Review article about the crisscross. I think it can help us better understand how we've gotten to where we are and maybe how we can work perhaps by trying to build a pro-life culture on both sides of the aisle, how we can try to get back there again. We'll be back with a new hour, including Archbishop Joseph Kurtz and Father Alan Carter for First Cup Theology, all coming back in a second. 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text if you've got a comment or question. This is the Mike Allen Show.